Obama followed up with a conciliatory address to the arch nemesis of everything progressive in America, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and with an order to federal agencies to review regulations for the purpose of eliminating some. When the 2010 congressional election rolled around, the enthusiasm gap between Republicans and Democrats was enormous. Obama's temporizing and lassitude had so demoralized his base that the Republicans won in a landslide, prompting him to reach out even further across the aisle. He quickly reneged on his promise to implement tougher environmental standards, announcing that he would forego new rules regarding smog and toxic emissions from boilers, leaving in place Bush administration policies. Even this didn't placate the Wall Street and corporate elite, who repaid Obama's largesse by throwing their support behind Mitt Romney in the 2012 elections. By April 2012, top banking executives, hedge fund operators, and private equity investors, the same people who had backed Obama 2-1 in 2008, were contributing 4 times as much to Romney as to Obama. And that doesn't include the enormous sums they were lavishing upon pro-Romney super PACs. As of summer 2012, General Electric employees, who had contributed 5 times as much to the Obama campaign as they did to McCain's in 2008, were backing Romney 4-1. And Immelt announced that he wouldn't be endorsing either candidate. Among the greatest disappointments to his followers was Obama's refusal to roll back the expanding national security state that so egregiously encroached on American civil liberties. He had actually gotten off to a promising start. On his first day in office, he rescinded a 2001 Bush executive order limiting access to former president's records and overturned a 2001 Ashcroft memo giving government agencies broad authority to reject public disclosure requests. He pledged his administration to a new transparency. "For a long time now, there's been too much secrecy in this city," he acknowledged. "This administration stands on the side not of those who seek to withhold information, but with those who seek to be known. The mere fact that you have the legal power to keep something secret does not mean you should always use it. Transparency and the rule of law will be the touchstones of this presidency." Obama's commitment to transparency did not last long. By summer 2010, the ACLU was warning about the very real danger that the Obama administration will enshrine permanently, within the law, policies and practices that were widely considered extreme and unlawful during the Bush administration. There is a real danger, in other words, that the Obama administration will preside over the creation of a new normal. That was precisely what Obama has done, a far cry from his campaign promises to defend the Constitution against Bush's trespasses. He had, for example, criticized Bush's repeatedly invoking state secrets to block lawsuits. In office, he reversed himself, impeding prosecution of Bush-era torture and other abuses, and advancing what the New York Times described as a sweeping view of executive secrecy powers. He has invoked the state secrets privilege more often than any previous president to halt lawsuits involving torture, extraordinary rendition, and illegal NSA wiretapping. He has continued the CIA's extraordinary rendition program, denied habeas corpus rights to Afghan prisoners, sanctioned military commissions, and authorized, without due process, the CIA killing of a U.S. citizen in Yemen who was accused of having ties to Al-Qaeda. His refusal to investigate and prosecute those in the Bush administration guilty of torture was itself a violation of international treaties. Bush Justice Department official Jack Goldsmith quickly recognized that Dick Cheney's rebuke of Obama for reversing the Bush-era terrorism policies was flat-out wrong. In fact, Goldsmith wrote in the New Republic, "The truth is closer to the opposite. The new administration has copied most of the Bush program, has expanded some of it, and has narrowed only a bit. Almost all of the Obama changes have been at the level of packaging, argumentation, symbol, and rhetoric. The Obama strategy," he concluded, "can thus be seen as an attempt to make the core Bush approach to terrorism politically and legally more palatable, and thus sustainable. Civil libertarians were appalled, expecting so much more from this former professor of constitutional law. His University of Chicago law school colleague, Jeffrey Stone, chairman of the board of the American Constitutional Society, decried the gap between Obama's policies and his campaign promises, regretting Obama's disappointing willingness to continue in his predecessor's footsteps. George Washington University law professor Jonathan Turley observed disappointedly that the election of Barack Obama may stand as one of the single most devastating events in our history for civil liberties. In many respects, Obama has been more secretive than the pathologically secretive Bush-Cheney administration. His government has classified more information and responded more slowly to Freedom of Information Act requests than his predecessor. It has prosecuted more government whistleblowers than all previous administrations, employing the 1917 Espionage Act in 6 separate cases, compared to a total of 3 in the 92 years before he took office. The most notorious case is that of Private Bradley Manning, a 22-year-old Army intelligence analyst in Iraq. Manning has been accused of leaking classified documents to WikiLeaks and was indicted on 34 counts, including violating the Espionage Act and aiding the enemy, which was potentially punishable by death. Some of the leaked documents, allegedly including the collateral murder video that showed U.S. troops coldly and calculatingly gunning down a dozen Iraqi civilians, including 2 Reuters journalists, revealed U.S. war crimes. Manning also allegedly leaked Iraq war logs that detailed atrocities and civilian death tolls far in excess of official government figures. Despite not having been convicted of any crime, Manning was kept naked for days and in solitary confinement for 9 months in conditions that many considered torture. Among those who bristled at Manning's horrendous treatment was P.J. Crowley, the State Department's top spokesman. Crowley described the treatment of Manning to students at MIT as ridiculous and stupid and counterproductive. 3 days later, Crowley resigned after 30 years of government service. Finally, in December 2011, after 19 months in military custody, Manning was given a military hearing to determine whether there was sufficient evidence to proceed with a court-martial. That the Obama administration had decided to prosecute Manning for disclosing the truth, but to let Bush, Cheney, and their associates off the hook for lying, torture, invading sovereign nations, and committing other war crimes, was a clear though sad indication of this administration's sense of justice and transparency. As law professor Marjorie Cohn observed, if Manning had committed war crimes instead of exposing them, he would be a free man today. Equally outrageous was the Obama administration's reaction to Julian Assange's release through WikiLeaks of over 250,000 diplomatic cables that he allegedly got from Manning. Assange made the mistake of not redacting names on the first batch released, but the intense reaction was due to the fact that the cables exposed the depths of U.S. government mendacity on a broad range of crucial issues, including the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan. Additional revelations of corruption and repression by U.S. allies helped spark the uprisings in Egypt, Libya, Yemen, and Tunisia that spurred what's become known as the Arab Spring. The impact on international journalism and public opinion was unprecedented. Articles based on the leaked documents appeared almost daily in leading newspapers throughout the world. As Glenn Greenwald correctly observed, WikiLeaks easily produced more newsworthy scoops over the last year than every other media outlet combined. In recognition of this contribution, in November 2011, WikiLeaks received the award for Most Outstanding Contribution to Journalism, Australia's equivalent of the Pulitzer Prize, from the Walkley Foundation. The foundation trustees applauded WikiLeaks for revealing an avalanche of inconvenient truths in a global publishing coup. Its revelations, from the way the war on terror was being waged, to diplomatic bastardry, high-level horse trading, and the interference in the domestic affairs of nations, have had an undeniable impact. Yet the Justice Department has been exploring ways to punish Assange and other individuals associated with the WikiLeaks release, possibly under the Espionage Act. Among the strongest backers of the Get Assange campaign were some who had earlier decried China and other repressive societies for limiting internet access and freedom of the press. Senate Intelligence Committee Chair Dianne Feinstein demanded that Assange be vigorously prosecuted for espionage. Joe Lieberman agreed. Newt Gingrich called him an enemy combatant. Sarah Palin wanted him targeted as if he were Al-Qaeda and hunted as an anti-American operative with blood on his hands. James Goodale, former New York Times general counsel in the Pentagon Papers case, described the corrosive effect such a prosecution would have on American press freedoms. Charging Julian Assange with conspiracy to commit espionage, he warned, would effectively be setting a precedent with a charge that more accurately could be characterized as conspiracy to commit journalism. Obama has tenaciously pursued whistleblowers and leakers, but his efforts were dealt a serious blow in June 2011, when the prosecutors dropped felony charges under the Espionage Act against Thomas Drake, an NSA employee who had courageously revealed to the Baltimore Sun that the NSA had wasted over $1 billion on a flawed trailblazer system for surveilling digital communications. He pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor for unauthorized use of a government computer and received no fine or jail time. The Drake case was the first the Obama Justice Department had brought under the Espionage Act. The Defense Department's internal watchdog issued a report exonerating Drake and upholding his allegations. The administration vowed to press on with its other cases, even though most were of equally dubious merit. Its vendetta against Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter James Risen, who broke the story about massive NSA wiretapping in 2005, sent a chilling message to all reporters who refused to name confidential sources, the lifeblood of information that the government wished to hide from the public. Furious with the embarrassing disclosures, Cheney had pressured the Bush Justice Department to investigate Risen's activities, but failed to secure an indictment. Obama, once again, took a stalled Bush initiative and looked to pursue it in ways that the ham-fisted Bush administration only dreamed about. In April 2010, the Justice Department subpoenaed Risen to testify. Risen made clear that he would go to jail rather than divulge his sources. In January 2011, the administration indicted former CIA officer Jeffrey Sterling for allegedly leaking classified information to Risen about a bungled 2000 operation to sabotage Iran's nuclear program, which Risen reported on in his 2006 book, State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration. Greenwald, a stalwart defender of civil liberties, condemned Obama's unparalleled assault. As in so many other instances, Greenwald averred, the Obama administration appears on the verge of fulfilling Dick Cheney's nefarious wish beyond what even Cheney could achieve. Political leaders and journalists around the world mocked America's democratic pretensions. Writers at London's Guardian, which, like the New York Times and Der Spiegel, had published the documents, led the assault. John Norton assailed the delicious irony of trying to shut WikiLeaks down. Seamus Milne wrote that official U.S. reaction is tipping over toward derangement. Not much truck with freedom of information then in the land of the free, he chortled. Norton observed that Hillary Clinton's 2009 rebuke of China for interfering with internet freedom reads like a satirical masterpiece. Nor did Obama do anything to restrain the enormous and rapidly proliferating security complex. In 2010, in a sobering four-part series, The Washington Post published the results of a two-year investigation into what it described as an alternative geography of the United States, a top-secret America hidden from public view and lacking in thorough oversight. In this world, 854,000 people with top-secret security clearances operate out of 1,271 government organizations and 1,931 private companies in about 10,000 U.S. locations, working on programs involving counterterrorism, homeland security, and intelligence. The Pentagon ran two-thirds of the programs. The intelligence budget reached well over $75 billion in 2009, more than 2.5 times its size before 9/11. The NSA intercepts and stores an astounding 1.7 billion emails, phone calls, and other communications each day. In the final installment of the series, The Post's Dana Priest and William Arkin reported that the United States is assembling a vast domestic intelligence apparatus to collect information about Americans, using the FBI, local police, state homeland security offices, and military criminal investigators. And many of the targets of the probe have not been accused of any wrongdoing, but were turned in for acting suspiciously. The monitoring was being done by 3,984 local, state, and federal organizations, often using methods introduced in Iraq and Afghanistan. The FBI had also collected 96 million sets of fingerprints at its data campus in Clarksburg, West Virginia. During the May 2011 congressional debate over extending the Patriot Act, Senate Democrats Ron Wyden and Mark Udall, both of whom were members of the Intelligence Committee, expressed outrage over the way the administration was interpreting certain provisions of the act. When the American people find out how their government has secretly interpreted the Patriot Act, they will be stunned and they will be angry, Wyden warned, citing reactions to past abuses like 1970s domestic spying, the Iran-Contra affair, and Bush's warrantless surveillance. The American people weren't paying sufficient attention. Congress extended the Patriot Act surveillance powers until 2015. The FBI significantly expanded the investigative powers of some 14,000 agents. The Supreme Court extended search and surveillance powers. Overall, Fourth Amendment guarantees of privacy and protections against unreasonable search and seizure, protections that were considered sacrosanct by the Founding Fathers, were being severely eroded. Civil libertarians were justifiably aghast at the new powers that the U.S. government had acquired since 9/11. Jonathan Turley listed 10. 1. Presidential power to order the assassination of U.S. citizens. 2. Indefinite detention. 3. Presidential power to decide whether prisoners will be tried in federal courts or military tribunals. 4. Warrantless surveillance. 5. Use of secret evidence in detentions and trials, and invoking the government's right to secrecy to force dismissal of cases against the United States. 6. Refusal to prosecute war criminals. 7. Increased use of secret foreign intelligence surveillance courts. 8. Immunity from judicial review for companies involved in warrantless surveillance of U.S. citizens. 9. Monitoring of citizens without court orders. 10. Extraordinary renditions of individuals to other countries, including those that commit torture. While Obama has disavowed use of some of these powers, his forbearance would in no way constrain future occupants of the Oval Office. And, as Turley aptly noted, an authoritarian nation is defined not just by the use of authoritarian powers, but by the ability to use them. If a president can take away your freedom or your life on his own authority, all rights become little more than a discretionary grant subject to executive will. As much of a disappointment as Obama was on domestic and security policy, his foreign policy may have been worse. His initial foreign policy advisors consisted primarily of Clinton administration veterans, including National Security Advisor Anthony Lake, Assistant Secretary of State Susan Rice, Navy Secretary Richard Danzig, Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin's Chief of Staff Michael Froman, and State Department official Gregory Craig. Also playing a significant role was Jimmy Carter's rabidly anti-communist National Security Advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski. The Washington Post reported, however, that closest to Obama during the campaign were two newcomers, Samantha Power, a professor of public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and retired Air Force Major General Scott Gratian. Gratian, a fighter pilot for most of his years in uniform, served as Director of Strategy and Planning under Marine General James Jones when he was Supreme Allied Commander in Europe. Hopes for fresh thinking centered mostly on Power, who was best known for her book, A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide, which made a liberal interventionist argument in cases where genocide was occurring, and on Obama himself. Power was forced to resign from the campaign after calling Hillary Clinton a monster, but returned as a senior aide on the National Security Council and aggressively pushed for U.S. intervention in Libya. Obama's own foreign policy experience was quite limited, and his views were conventional, if sometimes muddled. He told one campaign audience in Pennsylvania, "The truth is that my foreign policy is actually a return to the traditional bipartisan, realistic policy of George Bush's father, of John F. Kennedy, of, in some ways, Ronald Reagan." While untangling precisely what Obama meant by that bizarre conflation would be a challenge, what was clear was that he was not offering a decisive break with over a century of imperial conquest. His was a centrist approach to better managing the American empire, rather than advancing a positive role for the United States in a rapidly evolving world. He intended to reduce U.S. involvement in the Middle East and increase U.S. engagement with Asia, where American hegemony was being challenged by a resurgent and ever more potent China. "We've been on a little bit of a Middle East detour over the course of the last 10 years, Kurt Campbell, the Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs, noted, "and our future will be dominated utterly and fundamentally by developments in Asia and the Pacific region. The project of the first 2 years has been to effectively deal with the legacy issues that we inherited, particularly the Iraq War, the Afghan War, and the war against Al-Qaeda, while rebalancing our resources and our posture in the world," Benjamin Rhodes, one of Obama's deputy national security advisors, said. "If you were to boil it all down to a bumper sticker, it's wind down these two wars, reestablish American standing and leadership in the world, and focus on a broader set of priorities, from Asia and the global economy to a nuclear nonproliferation regime." With this in mind, Obama quickly moved to redress some of the more egregious aspects of Bush's policies. On his first day in office, he held discussions on withdrawal from Iraq and made clear his plans to be actively involved in Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations. He signed orders preventing people in the executive branch from accepting gifts from lobbyists and from lobbying the executive branch upon leaving government. His second day was even better. He barred enhanced interrogations, closed the CIA's black side prisons, and announced plans to shut the military prison at Guantanamo within 1 year. For a variety of reasons, Obama would fail to deliver on many of these promises. Opposition would come from lockstep Republicans, conservative Democrats, and sometimes even his own advisors. The Washington Post described Obama's incoming foreign policy team as experienced and centrist. His chief advisors, Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, Bush Republican holdover Robert Gates as Secretary of Defense, General James Jones, a John McCain ally, as National Security Advisor, and Admiral Dennis Blair, the former Chief of U.S. Pacific Command, as Director of National Intelligence, DNI, may have been experienced, but unfortunately, centrist would prove to be a stretch. Obama had said that if he had to take one book with him into the White House, it would be Doris Kearns Goodwin's Team of Rivals, which celebrated Abraham Lincoln's wisdom in bringing his political rivals and personal detractors into his cabinet. Obama followed those guidelines in choosing the hawkish Clinton and Gates, but he neglected to balance them with equally forceful critics of American empire. The results were predictable. In August 2009, neocon Elliot Cohen's Wall Street Journal op-ed titled, "What's Different About the Obama Foreign Policy?" reassured conservatives that very little had changed. The underlying structure of the policy remains the same. Moreover, because the Obama Foreign Policy senior team consists of centrist experts from the Democratic Party. It is unlikely to make radically different judgments about the world, and about American interests in it, than its predecessors. Gates was the principal guarantor of imperial continuity. A staunch cold warrior with close ties to the neocons, Gates's involvement in several scandalous situations, including allegedly delaying the release of U.S. hostages in Iran in 1980, and facilitating arms sales to both Iraq and Iran during their disastrous war, have never been fully investigated. During the Reagan years, he was instrumental in revamping CIA intelligence gathering, purging independent-minded analysts who wouldn't go along with the view of a menacing Soviet threat that justified an enormous U.S. military buildup. He was also a key proponent of Reagan's murderous policies in Central America, advocating illegal covert measures against the Sandinista regime in Nicaragua. Gates teamed with Clinton to frustrate those who hoped for reassessment of America's role in the world. "People are wondering what the future holds, at home and abroad," Clinton told the Council on Foreign Relations, CFR. "So let me say it clearly. The United States can, must, and will lead in this new century. We are still essentially, as has been said before, the indispensable nation," Gates concurred in November 2010. But in declaring a new American moment before the CFR, Clinton offered a version of American history stunning in its simplicity and vapidity. After the Second World War, the nation that had built the Transcontinental Railroad, the assembly line, the skyscraper, turned its attention to constructing the pillars of global cooperation. The Third World War that so many feared never came, and many millions of people were lifted out of poverty and exercised their human rights for the first time. Those were the benefits of a global architecture forged over many years by American leaders from both political parties. In speeches in Prague, Cairo, Oslo, and elsewhere, Obama articulated a more nuanced understanding of America's role in the world. But his ultimate message was largely the same as that of Clinton and Gates. Nothing was more disappointing than his Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech in December 2009. That a president waging two wars would receive the prize was preposterous in the first place. But the selection committee members must have been even more chagrined when they heard Obama's defense of American militarism in an address that came just days after announcing that he was sending additional forces to Afghanistan. An at times thoughtful speech about the complex problems facing the world was sullied by a defense of war, unilateralism, and preemption. Obama asserted presidential power in ways that must have made Dick Cheney jealous. In 2011, Obama defied his own top lawyers, insisting that he did not need congressional approval under the War Powers Resolution to continue military activities in Libya beyond the 60-day limits inscribed in the resolution. Offering a bizarre, some would say Orwellian interpretation, reminiscent of George W. Bush's definition of torture and Bill Clinton's definition of sex, Obama insisted that the U.S. military engagement was outside the legal definition of hostilities. Even hawkish House Speaker John Boehner was taken aback by Obama's assertion that prolonged bombing of Libya as part of an effort to assassinate Muammar Gaddafi and overthrow his regime didn't constitute hostilities. "The White House says there are no hostilities taking place," Boehner commented. "Yet we've got drone attacks underway. We're spending $10 million a day. We're part of an effort to drop bombs on Gaddafi's compounds. It just doesn't pass the straight-face test, in my view, that we're not in the midst of hostilities." Obama had rejected the views of Pentagon General Counsel Jay Johnson and acting head of the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel Carolyn Crass. Disregarding the opinion of the Office of Legal Counsel in such affairs was almost unprecedented. When asked during the 2008 primary campaign if a president could bomb Iran without congressional authorization, Obama responded, "The president does not have power under the Constitution to unilaterally authorize a military attack in a situation that does not involve stopping an actual or imminent threat to the nation." NATO went far beyond the limited UN resolution, authorizing it to take steps to protect Libyan civilians, thereby establishing a very dangerous precedent. Despite regime change in Libya, signs abounded that the American empire was in serious decline. U.S. ability to control events had eroded. WikiLeaks' November 2010 release of secret State Department cables prompted The Guardian's Simon Jenkins to decry the sheer ineptitude and wrong-headedness of U.S. foreign policy. The money wasting is staggering. The impression is of the world superpower roaming helpless in a world in which nobody behaves as bidden. Iran, Russia, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, the United Nations are all perpetually off script. Washington reacts like a wounded bear, its instincts imperial, but its power projection unproductive. Nowhere was this more apparent than Afghanistan, where U.S. forces had been bogged down since 2001 with the stated goal of defeating al-Qaeda. Obama shared this commitment, having promised during the campaign to end the war in Iraq so he could throw more resources into Afghanistan. Many tried to dissuade him from such folly. On June 30, 2009, Obama dined in the White House with nine of America's leading presidential historians, seeking their insights into what had enabled past presidents to succeed and what had caused them to fail. Because Obama indicated that he wanted such dinners to become an ongoing event, participants maintained their silence about what was discussed. More than a year later, Northwestern's Gary Wills finally broke his silence. "There has been no follow-up on the first dinner, and certainly no sign that he learned anything from it," Wills wrote in frustration. "The only thing achieved has been the silencing of the main point the dinner guests tried to make. The pursuit of war in Afghanistan would be for him what Vietnam was to Lyndon Johnson." As the meal was winding down, Obama had asked them to go around one more time for final words of advice. Wills recalled, "When my turn came, I joined those who had already warned him about an Afghanistan quagmire. I said that a government so corrupt and tribal and drug-based as Afghanistan's could not be made stable. He replied that he was not naive about the difficulties, but he thought a realistic solution could be reached. I wanted to add, when pigs fly, but restrained myself." By the time of that June meeting, Obama had already doubled down on the mess he inherited from Bush, regarding which a senior U.S. military commander informed the Washington Post during the final days of the Bush administration, "We have no strategic plan. We never had one." When Obama took office, the United States had 34,000 troops in the country. In February, he ordered 34,000 more to stabilize a deteriorating situation. In May, Gates, upon the urging of regional commander, General David Petraeus, fired General David McKiernan as commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan and replaced him with Lieutenant General Stanley McChrystal. McChrystal appeared to have been cast for the part by Stanley Kubrick. The Times described him as an ascetic who usually eats just one meal a day in the evening to avoid sluggishness, operates on a few hours sleep, and runs to and from work while listening to audiobooks on an iPod. He oversaw secret commando operations in Iraq for 5 years as head of the Secret Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC, running what Cy Hirsch called an executive assassination wing out of Cheney's office. According to the Times, former intelligence officials say that he had an encyclopedic, even obsessive knowledge about the lives of terrorists, and that he pushed his ranks aggressively to kill as many of them as possible. Some thought of him as a warrior scholar, others as a driven workaholic. McChrystal implemented a Petraeus-like counterinsurgency strategy inside Afghanistan, though he took greater pains to limit civilian casualties, and adopted a much more aggressive stance vis-a-vis Pakistan. Unlike McKiernan, McChrystal viewed Afghanistan and Pakistan as one thorny problem, having supported commando attacks on Taliban sanctuaries in Pakistan. Although McChrystal's days were numbered, targeted assassination would become the sine qua non of U.S. global strategy. Obama understood the strategic importance of Pakistan. "The cancer is in Pakistan," Obama acknowledged at a November 25, 2009, Oval Office meeting. Succeeding in Afghanistan was necessary, he insisted, so the cancer doesn't spread there. The U.S.-Pakistani relationship was marked by opportunism on both sides. In the 1980s, the United States worked closely with Pakistani intelligence, the Directorate for Inter-Services Intelligence, ISI, to train and supply the Holy Warriors who battled the Soviets in Afghanistan. In appreciation for Pakistani assistance, the United States turned a blind eye toward Pakistan's then-nascent nuclear program, which expanded at breakneck pace throughout the Bush-Obama years. By 2011, Pakistan possessed an arsenal estimated at 110 nuclear weapons, with enough fissile material to make 40 to 100 more, replacing France as the world's fifth-largest nuclear power. Despite substantial U.S. assistance in securing those weapons and materials, lax security made theft of bomb-making ingredients a real threat in a country rife with Islamic extremists, many of whom had been hardened with U.S. backing on the battlefields of Afghanistan. The U.S.-Pakistani alliance was a fragile one. Following Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan, it took U.S.-backed Mujahideen 3 more years to finally overthrow the Soviet-allied Najibullah government in 1992. Thereafter, U.S. interest in the region waned. President Pervez Musharraf, the former Pakistani army chief who took power in a 1999 coup, said that Pakistanis felt that they had been used and ditched by the United States. U.S. restoration of sanctions during the 1990s because of Pakistan's nuclear program further exacerbated tensions. After 9/11, the United States again sought Pakistani assistance, but this time the Pakistanis weren't so eager to lend a hand. The United States threatened to bomb them back to the Stone Age if they didn't comply with U.S. demands, including ending support for the Afghan Taliban. The United States paid Pakistan over $2 billion per year for assistance in driving the Taliban out of sanctuaries in the remote frontier areas near the Afghan border, from which the Taliban waged war against NATO forces. Pakistan proved a reluctant partner, targeting insurgents who struck within Pakistan while covertly harboring the two largest Taliban groups operating in Afghanistan. While the Pakistanis dragged their feet, the United States acted unilaterally. U.S. Special Forces and the CIA's counter-terrorism pursuit teams, a 3,000-man Afghan secret army, launched assaults into the ungoverned tribal regions where insurgents clustered. Pakistanis were outraged by U.S. violation of their sovereignty. Pakistanis particularly bristled at increased U.S. drone attacks inside Pakistan, which, the Washington Post reported, had left between 1,350 and 2,250 dead in Obama's first 3 years in office. Drones, which could be used for surveillance or attack, when equipped with Hellfire missiles, had increasingly become the U.S. weapon of choice in both Pakistan and Afghanistan. Obama authorized as many drone attacks in his first 9 months as Bush had in the preceding 3 years, leading to deaths of many innocent civilians. David Kilcullen, who had served as a counterinsurgency advisor to General David Petraeus from 2006 to 2008, and Andrew Exum, an army officer in Iraq and Afghanistan from 2002 to 2004, provided insight into Pakistani rage in May 2009. They cited Pakistani press reports indicating that over the past 3 years, U.S. drone strikes had killed 700 civilians and only 14 terrorist leaders, which equated to 50 civilians for every militant, a hit rate of 2%. While noting that U.S. officials vehemently denied these figures and acknowledging that they likely exaggerated the proportion of civilian casualties, Kilcullen and Exum warned that every one of these dead noncombatants represents an alienated family, a new desire for revenge, and more recruits for a militant movement that has grown exponentially, even as drone strikes have increased, and that visceral opposition was being expressed in areas of Pakistan, far from where the strikes were occurring. An accurate count of civilian casualties was hard to come by. Pakistan photographer Noor Behram, who hailed from the tribal region of Waziristan, where most of the strikes were occurring, held an exhibition in London in summer 2011 of graphic and grisly photos from 27 drone attacks. Behram lowered the ratio of civilians to terrorists a bit. For every 10 to 15 people killed, he found, maybe they get one militant. The New America Foundation placed the civilian toll at 20%. Behram's account of the aftermath sounds strikingly familiar to the effects of U.S. bombing in other wars. There are just pieces of flesh lying around after a strike. You can't find bodies. So the locals pick up the flesh and curse America. They say that America is killing us inside our own country, inside our own homes, and only because we are Muslims. The youth in the area surrounding a strike gets crazed. Hatred builds up inside those who have seen a drone attack. The Americans think it is working, but the damage they're doing is far greater. Faisal Shahzad, the Pakistani-born U.S. citizen who is best known as the Times Square bomber, is a case in point. Shortly after his arrest, he asked, "How would you feel if people attacked the United States? You are attacking a sovereign Pakistan." At his trial, when asked by the judge how he could risk killing innocent women and children, he responded that U.S. drone strikes don't see children. They don't see anybody. They kill women, children, they kill everybody. To the Pakistanis, the victims were human beings. To the drone operators, they were bug splats. No wonder 97% of Pakistanis told Pew researchers that they viewed U.S. drones negatively, and the number who saw the United States as an enemy jumped from 64% in 2009 to 74% in 2012. No wonder so many were incensed at the smug indecency of President Obama's comment at the May 2010 White House Correspondents Association dinner upon spotting the popular teenage Jonas Brothers band members in the audience. Referring to his daughters, Obama quipped, "Sasha and Malia are huge fans, but boys don't get any ideas. Two words for you, predator drones. You will never see it coming." In spring 2012, only 7% of Pakistanis held a positive view of Obama. Obama's tasteless remarks were at least an attempt at humor, though one on a par with George Bush's feigned search for WMD under his Oval Office desk 6 years earlier. In June 2011, Obama's counterterrorism advisor, John Brennan, claimed with a straight face that for almost a year, there hasn't been a single collateral death from the drone attacks. An assertion that drone supporter Bill Roggio, who followed the strikes closely as editor of the Long War Journal, dismissed as absurd. Shortly thereafter, Britain's Bureau of Investigative Journalism reported that based on interviews in the tribal areas, at least 45 civilians had been killed in 10 strikes in the past year. Brennan could make such a ludicrous claim in part because Obama had classified any military-age male who happened to be in a strike zone as a combatant. That apparently included civilians who had tried to help rescue victims or had the bad judgment to attend funerals of combatants, dozens of whom had been killed by CIA drones, the Bureau reported in February 2012. In 2010, with Pakistani anger exploding, U.S. Ambassador Cameron Munter complained that the operation was out of control. "He didn't realize his main job was to kill people," a colleague said. Obama and Biden saw increased use of drones as a way to punish the Taliban and Al-Qaeda without an expanded troop commitment. But others recognized the questionable legal status of such targeted assassinations and worried about the future implications of a world in which such lethal technology was widely dispersed. In fact, prior to 9/11, the United States had opposed targeted killing by other nations. In 2000, U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Martin Indyk, condemned Israeli targeting of Palestinians. "The United States government," he said, "is very clearly on the record as being against targeted assassinations. They are extrajudicial killings and we do not support that." Obama signaled his intention to not only aggressively pursue Bush's war on terror, but to expand the use of drones in doing so, even before he took office. A former CIA official disclosed that Obama's transition teams assured agency personnel that they were going to be as tough, if not tougher, than the Bush people. They basically shit-canned the interrogation board, but they wanted to make it clear that they weren't a bunch of left-wing pussies, that they would be focusing and upping the ante on the Predator program. Drone usage would expand on Obama's watch from Pakistan, the only country targeted when Bush left office, to six countries over the next 3+ years, as the United States added Islamic rebels in the Philippines to the list in February 2012. Critics agreed with Tom Engelhardt's astute observation that drones put wings on the Bush-era Guantanamo principle that Washington has an inalienable right to act as a global judge, jury, and executioner, and in doing so remain beyond the reach of any court of law. What was not appreciated until later was the direct, hands-on involvement of the president himself in targeting specific individuals who were put on official kill lists. In 2006, former Vice President Al Gore expressed outrage over George Bush's exercise of powers and wondered whether there were any limits to what presidents could do. Gore asked, "If the president has the inherent authority to eavesdrop on American citizens without a warrant, imprison American citizens on his own declaration, kidnap and torture, then what can't he do?" Obama's targeted assassinations provided a chilling answer. Glenn Greenwald warned that the power to order people executed, including U.S. citizens, is far too extreme and dangerous to vest in one person without any checks, review, oversight, or transparency. After all, he reminded readers, it was a consensus among Democrats that George Bush should be forced to obtain judicial review before merely spying on or detaining people, let alone ordering them executed by the CIA. The Obama administration kept a tight veil of secrecy around the program, refusing to divulge information about targeting or casualties. The CIA, which conducted the attacks in Pakistan, even refused to acknowledge that such a program existed. But drone warfare had breathed new life into an agency that had been left for dead after 9/11. You've taken an agency that was chugging along and turned it into one hell of a killing machine, one former official declared. In the decade after 9/11, the CIA's counterterrorism center staff had grown sevenfold. Approximately 20% of CIA analysts were now targeters, and 35% supported drone operations. The overall cost and complexity of the operation was immense. Each combat drone required a team of at least 150 people to maintain it and ready it to strike its target. The Air Force, which ran the drones in Iraq and Afghanistan, was spending $5 billion per year to operate the program, and the cost was increasing rapidly. The Pentagon requested an additional $5 billion for 2012. The JSOC carried out additional strikes in Yemen and Somalia. Strikes were being launched in late 2011 from more than 60 widely scattered bases by pilots wearing the same green flight suits as fighter pilots and maneuvering drones with joysticks and video game-like computer screens. Plans were in the works to supplement these land-based drones with aircraft carrier-based attack planes that could be deployed in the Pacific and strike targets from three times as far away as Navy fighter jets. The United States was working on miniaturizing these remotely operated intelligence gathering and killing machines to the size of birds and even insects and promoting them as the future face of warfare. In 2011, the Pentagon disclosed plans to spend close to $40 billion over the next decade to add more than 700 medium and large drones to a stockpile that in 2012 totaled more than 19,000, including mini-drones. The Air Force already had more pilots learning to fly drones than it had pilots training to fly aircraft. There were also plans to supply soldiers with thousands of hand-launchable mini-drones for surveying areas and dive-bombing enemy forces. But U.S. allies and U.N. officials questioned the legality of such targeted assassinations. Further concerns about legality were aroused when the United States killed U.S.-born al-Qaeda supporter Anwar al-Awlaki and Samir Khan, a naturalized American citizen, in Yemen in late September 2011. The following month, another strike killed Orlaki's 16-year-old U.S.-born son. In July 2012, relatives of the victims joined with the ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights to file a wrongful death lawsuit against Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, CIA Director Petraeus, and two senior commanders of the military's Special Operations Forces on the grounds that the killings violated fundamental rights afforded to all U.S. citizens, including the right not to be deprived of life without due process of law. The Orlakis and Khan were among the many victims of the Yemeni drone campaign. Much like in Pakistan, the drones were creating far more enemies than they were killing. When the U.S. began its Yemeni drone campaign in 2009, Al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula had fewer than 300 militants in Yemen. By mid-2012, that number had jumped to over 700. As the Washington Post reported, the stepped-up targeting in southern Yemen was stirring increasing sympathy for Al-Qaeda-linked militants and driving tribesmen to join a network linked to terrorist plots against the United States. The Post quoted one Yemeni businessman who lost two brothers, a teacher and a cell phone repairman, in a U.S. strike as stating, "These attacks are making people say, we believe now that Al-Qaeda is on the right side." Hundreds of tribesmen had also joined the fight not out of sympathy for Al-Qaeda, but out of hatred toward the United States. "The drones are killing Al-Qaeda leaders, but they are also turning them into heroes," warned a local human rights activist. For American policymakers, drones represented an ingenious, low-cost, low-risk form of robotic warfare that kills enemies from thousands of miles away, without endangering U.S. forces. Critics, however, deplored this cowardly form of remote long-distance killing. Thailand's Nation newspaper wrote acerbically that, "Drones satisfy our selfish and rather lily-livered need to eavesdrop, kill, and destroy, without facing the slightest chance of reciprocation in kind." The Army was also experimenting with killer robots that could supplement or replace combat troops. One robot design being tested in Fort Benning, Georgia, operated in conjunction with surveillance drones and was equipped with a grenade launcher and a machine gun. Many feared that these new steps in mechanized warfare, by greatly limiting the numbers of Americans coming home in body bags, would lower the threshold for going to war. "Wars will be started very easily and with minimal costs," warned Wendell Wallach, who chaired the Technology and Ethics Study Group at Yale's Interdisciplinary Center for Bioethics. For Engelhardt, drones were simply the latest in a long line of wonder weapons, guaranteed to ensure American military hegemony, from atomic bombs to hydrogen bombs, to the Vietnam-era electronic battlefield, to Reagan's missile defense shield, to the first Gulf War's smart bombs. Doubt was cast upon their wonder weapon status in late 2011, when Iranians displayed an RQ-170 Sentinel that they had brought down intact while it was spying over their territory. More than two dozen others had crashed up to that point, but none with so much fanfare or such embarrassing consequences. Some expressed concern that the Iranians would reverse engineer the drone and learn its secrets. Dick Cheney demanded that Obama send planes to destroy the downed aircraft while it lay grounded. But it was too late. The cat was already out of the bag. More than 50 countries, some friendly and some hostile to the United States, had already purchased drones, and several had their own sophisticated drone programs in place. Most of those purchased were of the surveillance variety, but the United States had sold attack drones to close allies. In 2009, the United States punished Israel, which was second only to the United States in drone manufacture, for selling an attack drone to China. WikiLeaks revealed that Israel had angered U.S. authorities by selling advanced model drones to Russia. Among the other countries that claimed to have mastered manufacturing drones with lethal capabilities were Russia, India, and even Iran. In summer 2010, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad displayed a model he called the Ambassador of Death. But the main challenge to U.S. ambitions and pretensions appeared to come from China, which had the most dynamic program outside the United States. By 2011, 5 years after publicly displaying its first drone, China boasted over 24 varieties, with more on the way. And, most troubling, China appeared to have no compunctions about selling armed drones to other nations. China's Aviation Industry Corp. offered customers a model comparable to the U.S. Predator called the Yilong, pterodactyl in English, that combined combat and surveillance capabilities. Among the countries lining up to buy combat models from China was sometime U.S. ally Pakistan. Leading U.S. defense contractors like General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, whose advanced Predators and MQ-9 Reapers sold for over $10 million each, clamored to get in on this market and pressured the U.S. government to ease export controls. Vice Admiral William Landay III, director of the Defense Security Cooperation Agency, which oversaw such sales, instructed his subordinates to determine in advance which countries could purchase drones with which capabilities, so U.S. manufacturers would be ready to hit the ground running when they got the green light. By using the rationale that it was engaged in a battle against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban that was not restricted to hot battlefields as a justification for targeted assassinations in multiple countries, the United States was establishing a dangerous precedent. As Human Rights Watch pointed out, what was to stop China from targeting Uyghur activists living in New York City, or Russia from killing Chechen militants in London? Director of National Intelligence, Admiral Dennis Blair, who had tried to curb drone attacks and other CIA covert activities, believing them a blot on America's reputation, was replaced in 2010 by retired Lieutenant General James Clapper, the former head of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, who defended such actions. Blair complained that the White House's obsession with drone strikes had replaced serious strategizing about how to defeat Al-Qaeda. The steady refrain in the White House was, "This is the only game in town." Reminded me of body counts in Vietnam, Blair observed. In Afghanistan, U.S. officials touted drone attacks as an improvement over the aerial bombardment that marked the earlier stages of the war. In March 2010, the New York Times reported that civilian deaths caused by American troops and American bombs have outraged the local population and made the case for the insurgency. U.S. bombs had killed thousands of Afghan civilians. Many others were shot at checkpoints. Command Sergeant Major Michael Hall, the senior NATO enlisted man in Afghanistan, said that many of those imprisoned at the Bagram Air Base had joined the insurgency after the deaths of people they knew. "There are stories after stories about how these people are turned into insurgents," he told his troops. "Every time there is an escalation of force, we are finding that innocents are being killed." Obama and his advisors had been reading Lessons in Disaster, Gordon Goldstein's cautionary study of the deepening U.S. involvement in Vietnam. Goldstein shows how foreign policymakers' failure to question basic assumptions about a monolithic communist threat and the domino theory had led the U.S. astray. Obama determined not to make the same mistakes in dealing with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Obama understood that getting bogged down in Afghanistan would doom his presidency, much as Vietnam had destroyed Johnson's. Having already increased the U.S. troop commitment and declared that winning the war was vital to America's national interests, he now sought options that would limit U.S. involvement and offer an exit strategy. But, as Washington Post staff writer Bob Woodward has skillfully shown, he was boxed in and outflanked by his top military advisors, Mike Mullen, Petraeus, McChrystal, who, with the aid of Secretaries Gates and Clinton, pushed for 40,000 additional troops, an expanded mission, including full-scale counterinsurgency organized around military-led nation-building, and an open-ended commitment. Obama demanded they provide additional options. But at a September 30th meeting, he eliminated the one option that made sense, telling his national security advisors, "I want to take off the table that we're leaving Afghanistan." Still, he made clear he didn't want a commitment that would last 10 years and cost $1 trillion. The military leaders, he charged angrily at the November 11, 2009 strategy review session, had presented only the one foolhardy option. To make matters worse, all three had publicly stated that anything less than their desired troop buildup would result in a humiliating defeat, a view that was immediately trumpeted by the leading neocons and their allies in the media. New York Times and Washington Post editors did all they could to back the hawks. The Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Media and Reporting, FAIR, surveyed all Times and Post op-eds during the first 10 months of 2009 that addressed the direction of U.S. policy in Afghanistan. The Times, despite having been scandalized by Judith Miller's role in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq, ran 36 columns supporting the war and only 7 opposing it. The ratio was more than 10-1 in the Post, whose editors were very explicit about where they stood. Breaking with McChrystal's war policy, the Post editorialized in September 2009, would both dishonor and endanger this country. Biden and Marine General James Cartwright, the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs, proposed a scaled-back approach that would still increase troops by 20,000, but reject nation-building and population protection, thereby promising a much quicker exit. They wanted to focus on weakening and dividing the Taliban in hopes of reconciliation and on training Afghan forces. Gates and Mullen later punished Cartwright for his dissent by blocking his elevation to chairman of the Joint Chiefs, even after Obama had informed him that he had the job. What Afghanistan actually needed was economic aid and social reform, not more U.S. troops. The depths of Afghan poverty was staggering. As of 2009, even with U.S. dollars flooding the country, Afghanistan was still the world's 5th poorest nation, with one of the widest gaps between rich and poor. Per capita income stood at $426. 68% of the population lived on less than a dollar per day. Only 23% had access to sanitary drinking water. Average life expectancy was 43 years. 24% of adults could read and write, but only 14% of women. Even in 2011, a decade into the war, only 30% of girls attended school. Despite such enormous need, the United States was spending over $100 billion annually on military efforts and only $2 billion on sustainable development. The Center for American Progress reported that even the Soviet Union spent more on reconstruction than the United States had. But even that paltry sum was in shocking excess of what the Afghan government could generate. Anthony Cordesman of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, who was part of McChrystal's civilian advisory team in 2009, wrote that outside aid is some 14 times higher than the Kabul government's revenue-generating capability. The condition of Afghan women was particularly deplorable. They had been suffering terribly ever since the United States and its allies overthrew the Soviet-backed regime, whose unpopularity was partly due to its egalitarian impulses toward women. Liberating women from Taliban repression had been one of the U.S. justifications for invading in the first place. But, as Atiq Sarwari and Robert Cruz reminded readers, within a 25-year period, Afghan women became the object of emancipation at the hands of 4 separate regimes: the communists, the mujahideen, the Taliban, and the American-led coalition, all presented the amelioration of the plight of women as an obligation that made their rule legitimate. And in the rural areas, where the overwhelming majority of Afghans live, little had changed, and infant and maternal mortality rates remained among the highest in the world, although they, like life expectancy, had recently shown signs of improving. In some Taliban-controlled southern provinces, fewer than 1% of girls attended middle school. David Wildman and Phyllis Bennis wrote, "Arming one group of men with a terrible record on rights, so they could overthrow another group of men with a terrible record on women's rights, has done little to improve the situation for women. Afghan women remain unequal in law, in health, and in life." In 2009, Afghanistan still ranked second worst on the UN's Gender-Related Development Index, measuring, among other things, female literacy, access to education, and life expectancy. And that was after 8 years of U.S. occupation and reform. Under the circumstances, more U.S. troops was the last thing Afghanistan needed, and many people tried to save Obama from making a colossal blunder. In early November, U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan, Carl Eikenberry, wrote 2 secret memos to Hillary Clinton, warning that the counterinsurgency policy was failing and troop increases would backfire. Eikenberry, who had been the commander of U.S. troops in the country for 18 months in 2006 and 2007, cautioned, "The last time we sent substantial additional forces, a deployment totaling 33,000 in 2008 to 2009, overall violence and instability in Afghanistan intensified." And he made clear, "More troops won't end the insurgency as long as the Pakistan sanctuaries remain." The corruption of Afghan President Hamid Karzai and the incompetence of the Afghan army and police only made the situation more hopeless. Others with knowledge of the region concurred. In September 2009, 4 former top intelligence officials